It's time for a quick quiz. Can you name all the women who've won Oscars for directing movies? There's a reason it's a quick quiz. Only one woman ever won an Oscar for directing. That was Kathryn Bigelow for The Hurt Locker. The big movie industry is slowly increasing the numbers of women in positions of power, so a lot of women making movies do so as independents. And the stories of 15 of them are told in the book Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. It is edited and partly written by Michelle Meek, who is an assistant professor of communication studies at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. Michelle writes and directs films and has worked in film distribution, festivals, and media journalism, among other duties. Michelle Meek, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
There's another credit line here I left out that's very important. You founded Independent Media Publications. What is that?
It was an organization, or it is an organization, that took over the archives of the Independent Film and Video Monthly, which was a print magazine from 1976 to 2006, and since then has operated as an online publication.
Still something of a Bible, it sounds like, for people in the independent filmmaking business.
Absolutely. It has, and the interviews in my book, in fact, are then and now, and the first interviews were all from the Independent Film and Video Monthly.
All right, so there's definitely some precedent here. The for the people who don't get the terminology, Michelle, independent filmmakers are independent from what?
Well, the interesting thing about the word independent is that it has been interpreted to mean different things. Generally, what I think of when I think of independent filmmaking is outside of the Hollywood studio system. The reason it's become confusing is because many of the studios have actually developed their own independent studios within, under their umbrella, and so they're also making independent films of sorts, but they're still, you know, it's different when someone is making it and has to go and seek the funding themselves.
All right, so it's independent with quotes, I guess, when the big guys do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Patricia White points out in her preface to the book that the financial support for films is very different in the United States from a lot of other countries.
That is true. European countries and Canadian filmmakers, they get more support from the government for filmmaking. That said, those industries are also a lot smaller when you compare them to filmmaking in the United States. So independent filmmakers here do have access to grants from their local state and, you know, government agencies, and there are some grants through the NEA and other large organizations. They're just extremely competitive, but they are in Europe and Canada as well.
All right, but it sounds like a lot more of a scrap for money to get a film made in the United States.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the thing that we have to think about when we talk about independent film is that it's not always by choice that someone is an independent filmmaker, right? Sometimes it's out of necessity because they haven't been able to break into the more traditional Hollywood system. And, you know, the question is, once they're there making those films, how do they have an impact? And, you know, when they, yeah. So, I mean, it's about everyone wants to have an impact. Nobody really wants to be independent. The only reason you would be an independent filmmaker is because you want to have total creative control, which you have a lot more of when you're independent. But everybody wants maximum impact. You don't make a film and hope no one sees it.
Right, right. You want to make sure that it reaches an audience for sure. But,
right.
But so even outside the Hollywood studio system and outside the big companies, in the independent film world, is it still a very much male-dominated kind of field?
Unfortunately, yes. So the statistics are slightly better in the independent film arena than the Hollywood arena, but they're still a lot smaller than you might expect, especially when you're talking about narrative or fiction filmmaking compared to documentary filmmaking, which is generally a little bit more equal.
And there's a point in the front of the book that sort of underscores where this goes and where it has gone, at least so far. The University of Mississippi put out a series of books of interviews, press conversations with filmmakers, University of Mississippi Press, I should say, conversations with filmmakers. So it's 108 books of interviews with filmmakers, 7 of them women.
Right. I mean, frankly, I don't find any good excuse for that because there are lots of women directors who have made numerous films and have many interviews with them. So if that is the criteria of the book series, which is what I understand it to be, then there should be plenty of female filmmakers to include in that series. And I don't really understand why they're not there.
Does it get down to a chicken and egg thing, Michelle, from some people's perspective, that there aren't a lot of women recognized because there aren't a lot of women participating, whereas the women participating could say, well, there aren't that many getting recognized, you know, there aren't that many participating because there aren't that many getting recognized?
Well, I think, you know, the reason I started the More Women Filmmakers hashtag a little bit ago was because I think it's a double-edged thing. It's, you know, there are more women filmmakers than you might realize, which I think my book, you know, is a testament to. But it's also there should be more women filmmakers that are, getting out there and getting their work made and seen.
There are, it seems, at least more women writers now. Is that a fair thing to say? Is that where the people, women, really seem to be breaking through?
Well, I think that has often been the case. And some of the filmmakers in my book actually ended up doing more writing than filmmaking when they had trouble funding their next film. So that has been an avenue for filmmakers to go. But when you're a director, you want to write and direct films. You know, that's what you do. So it can be very frustrating when you're not able to get that funding, and then you're writing, which is satisfying, but it's not the same creative control that a director has. It just isn't.
There are certainly some names that people recognize in the book. I know when I was going through one section about somebody else's films, I ran across the name of Shonda Rhimes, who's well known for her TV production work and her huge recent contract with Netflix and all that stuff. But we're talking about independent filmmakers here. The book is called Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. Michelle Meek is the editor and did a fair amount of the writing as well. We'll come back and talk more with Michelle. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can come in by phone or email, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Michelle Meek, independent female filmmakers, and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Michelle Meek, an assistant professor of communication studies at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. She is also an independent filmmaker and is the founder of Independent Media Publications, which publishes the journal about independent filmmakers. She's written a book, or edited a book, actually, Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos of people who've been really trying hard to get films made in the system, but often end up making independent films because Hollywood's still very closed to women in a lot of ways. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Michelle, was this book already coming together before the breaking of the Me Too wave?
Oh, absolutely. So this was an idea that was long stewing. I've always been a supporter of women filmmakers and had this idea of using interviews from The Independent and putting together a book. And then the idea was to really reconnect with them so we could see their legacy through time, and they could also reflect on their own careers and how they want their work to be interpreted. And so we really wanted to prioritize their voices in this book so that their work could be remembered the way that they want it to be.
I'm struggling with that idea because you want people to interpret things. I mean, art is art. People will take different things away from it, won't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, there's absolutely no question of that. I think it's interesting, though, to hear what the filmmakers had as their intent, or not that it should guide you in any particular way, but it should make you see the work in a different way. And I think it's important to record what their intent was. You know, and it was interesting to talk to someone like Martha Coolidge, who directed Valley Girl and Real Genius, and to hear what films she thinks of as her real body of work and what films she would rather you not see. Not that you shouldn't see them, but that, you know, that's how she feels about it.
I was really struck by the Martha Coolidge interview in the book. She made mainstream films, as you pointed out, but man, she really paid some dues for those, didn't she?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she had made over a dozen films before anyone in Hollywood took a notice of her. And even then, you know, I think her career was always precarious because she was a female filmmaker. I mean, having made Valley Girl and Real Genius, her career should have been set in stone for good at that point. And yet she still had trouble finding projects. And she also was very committed to independent film as well. And that's why she made projects like Introducing Dorothy Dandridge and Rambling Rose, because she wanted to work with actresses like Halle Berry and Laura Dern. And she wanted to make work that she felt strongly about, that she had more creative control over.
Well, where she didn't have creative control was that reference you made to movies that she'd rather not be remembered for. I mean, that reaction, I was struck by the reaction to the films that she made, but the studio ultimately controlled.
Right. And she found that, you know, sometimes working in television, a notable exception, she says, was HBO, that which gave filmmakers a great deal of creative control. But sometimes working with television, the producers would come in and say, cut a few frames here or change this or that. And she was perplexed, having been a film director, thinking, isn't that what I do with my editor? Why are you telling me how many frames to cut here?
Which goes, it takes us down the road of the director's cut. If the director doesn't have it, then who decides? And it sounds like in the case of TV, certainly the TV producers, but you always have somebody sort of above the director as the ultimate authority on a film, it sounds like, unless the director can specify in advance on a studio project, I get the final cut.
To some extent, the person in charge is always the person who's paying, right? I mean, and then it depends on how much that person or those people, those producers, want to give freedom to the directors themselves or the editors. You know, an outlet like HBO really prioritizes directors having more creative control, and so they were less invasive in those ways than some other networks.
So it sounds like you have options, like you can have complete control but no money, or complete money but no control.
Right, exactly. It's a tough decision, and it's hard to find the balance between those. And that's why, you know, independent filmmaking is sort of ironic in the sense that it's not always a choice, but once you're doing it, there are some benefits to it in the fact that you have more creative control.
Michelle Meek, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the editor of the book Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. So what's in the book? I mean, some of this is interviews, I noticed. Some stuff you wrote, a lot of other people's writing in here.
Right. So I provide an introduction to sort of frame the context of the text itself and to offer my opinion about how we should move forward in remembering female filmmakers, which I really think is important to not only look forward and make sure that women are getting equal opportunities in filmmaking, but also look back and remember the legacy of the women filmmakers who have made important work that are in danger of being forgotten, frankly, because, you know, the ones that have won Academy Awards and et cetera, who are in the National Film Registry, who are being featured in that University of Mississippi Press series that you mentioned, they're not there. So if we don't continue to think about those past films, their legacy will be forgotten. But then in the book, it's a combination of profiles and manifestos that the filmmakers wrote and also interviews with them. Really, like I said, prioritizing their voice and their, their thoughts one-on-one with interviewees and, I mean, with interviewers.
And you have about the three generations of filmmakers in here. It goes as far back as Yvonne Rainer, still alive, born 1934, and Miranda July, the youngest, I think, born 1974. So a good
right,
good range
absolutely,
here.
And a big span of types of work too, because you know there's a filmmaker like Annie Sprinkle who was making films that were somewhat pornographic, and then there's art films by Erica Beckman, and she's done more installations of late, and then Martha Coolidge, who directed both independent and Hollywood filmmaking, and then someone like Cheryl Dunier, who has done more solely independent film. So it's a real range. And then there's one Canadian filmmaker, Deepa Mehta, who has, she is an Oscar-winning filmmaker, and she was a very interesting interviewee as well.
Aside from the how long it seems to be taking to get women into positions of authority in the business, I'm looking at some of the other transitions going on here. The fact is it's so easy to make a movie now. You can basically make one with a phone and still have high quality pictures in it. But I just wonder how much else the industry is changing. I mean, it seems like a lot more people can make films now.
Absolutely. I think there is starting to be, I mean, the technology has totally transformed filmmaking, absolutely. And so, you know, the type of funding that you need to get to make a project has a lot to do with the labor involved in it and, you know, locations and sets and things like that. So depending on your budget, you have those or you don't, you know, in abundance. But, and then also, are you paying your cast and crew? I mean, some independent films are doing everything with deferred pay, so they're not necessarily paying cast and crew at the time, unless the film were to make money, which often it doesn't. But, you know, independent filmmakers who were working on this level, they talk about all different ways of getting their films made. And even when they were making them, where they were doing it on, you know, 16 or 35 millimeter film, how they were able to get over those hurdles. And I think it's important as a filmmaker to really think practically, but also creatively about how you can get the funding you need to make your project.
Have there been some funding fights over the years? I mean, I gather there from some of the chapters in the book that there have always been issues like with the National Endowment for the Humanities and the NEA, and that's vulgar, that's not vulgar, some of the ways in which members of Congress get involved.
Right. You know, it's always hard when public funding is going towards something, and then it really ends up being about, is this appropriate for the public to be funding? But I think the conversation now, at least, is a lot different. I mean, I'm calling into question the public funding of the National Film Registry, which I absolutely support, but I think should be more diverse. I mean, if it's meant to represent us as a culture, then it shouldn't have, 7% female directed films on that list. It should be more equal. It's meant to be representative of everyone.
So, again, we're talking to Michelle Meek, who is the editor of the book Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. You're welcome to join our conversation about independent filmmaking, particularly where it concerns women. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's bring in a call from Anna in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michelle Meek.
Thank you. Catherine Marshall, I believe that's her name.
Kathleen Marshall.
Last arc, the wealthiest woman producer of Fortune 500 woman in the industry. Has she done anything to promote women directors?
That's a good question. Kathleen Marshall is certainly a very very powerful figure in the mainstream movie industry, but I don't know what she's done about other people's careers. Are you up to speed on that, Michelle?
I can't speak to that, to be honest. I don't know. I mean, I know that in general, there is a lot more awareness of mentorship within the industry and the importance of women supporting other women. And I'm seeing a lot now, women posting for looking for female crew specifically. You know, the idea is really starting to emerge that if we don't support each other, then how are we going to get to the next level? And filmmakers are thinking really consciously about that. And I think that even the studios are. I mean, there was a study at the RAF saying that there were going to be five times more female-directed studio films this next year than there have been. And granted, it's still going to be a real minority. But that's an enormous shift, actually. And so I think we're seeing that the public awareness on this issue is going to make a change. We just have to keep up and sustain the energy around it.
Jeff in Ashland sent an email. He says, I had the good fortune to work under director Rachel Talalay on the film Tank Girl. I was struck by her easygoing, innovative, skillful approach in working with her crew and talent. I think the industry will improve on many levels with more women getting the opportunity to direct. That again from Jeff in Ashland. Thoughts from you on that, Michelle?
I think that's great. I mean, you know, I think with female directors, there's been a misunderstanding that somehow it's not appropriate women's work, which is obviously ridiculous and outdated. And I think that, you know, especially in terms of the technology, sometimes there have been women who felt like, oh, wait, can I learn how to deal with all this equipment and camera, et cetera? And I think that we need to just stop having those kinds of thoughts. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's clear that there's no logical reason that a woman can't direct a film just as well as a man. And so it's just a matter of allowing that opportunity and getting rid of those ideas, because, you know, almost all of the women directors in the book talk about how they were questioned sometimes by either men producers or people on the set. You know, you're the director. Do you know what you're doing? That kind of thing. And there's really no reason that idea should exist.
I'm struck again by how things are changing, both on the making end and the receiving end. I mean, obviously on the making end, the technology makes it so much easier than it used to be. You can basically make a movie with a small camera and no lights at this point. But also the way we get stuff, you know, through Netflix and streaming services like that, and Amazon Prime and Hulu and you name it. But also other avenues that don't necessarily involve people watching films in places where they used to watch films. There's a chapter here on Emily Beckman where she talks about indie films going to museums. That sounds like an avenue that wasn't available a couple of decades ago anyway.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, the way we watch and consume media is totally transforming. And I have some optimism that this is going to be a good thing for female and diverse filmmakers. For the one thing, I think that whenever it means that we can make media for less money and get it out there for less money, that's going to automatically create the opportunity, I think, for more diverse visions. Because one of the problems with Hollywood in general is that they're extremely risk averse and they spend a lot of money on each movie. So, you know, they want to make sure it's going to work. I mean, it's no accident that they keep making more Marvel pictures. You know, they've found a model that works and they want to kind of keep with it. So, they need, in order to have more risky work, you need to be able to produce it and get it out there for less money. And I think that's one of the things that some of these other streaming platforms is able to do.
I think I might have given her the wrong name a moment ago. We were talking about, it was Kathleen Kennedy, as in Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall. I think I called her Kathleen Marshall, but that was where my brain went.
Okay.
Yeah, she's the head of Lucasfilm now. And yes, if you look at movies over the years, you can almost so many particularly made for TV projects that you see Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall listed at the end as the producers. So a huge inside the business, in the big Hollywood business. I want to move on to another name here, Lizzie Borden. I think you touched on briefly, but expand on her and let us know what she's best known for.
So she's best known for her films Born in Flames and Working Girls. And her films really were depicting intersectionality and, the pro-sex feminist movement at a time that was very early. And, you know, I think that her film, Born in Flames, has been resurrected of late. And she's actually been going and speaking a lot of places with the film because it is a depiction of intersectionality of, you know, race, sexuality, and gender. Kind of crossing to form an identity that was really early on, before the term was even really used.
I noticed that she's the first of a couple of people in the book to use the term a woman's gaze. And how does she use it?
Well, I think that, you know, Laura Mulvey, who was the one who coined the idea of the male gaze, that was obviously extremely influential, but then there were others that came after and said, well, you know, women are making films and women are watching films critically. And so what does the female gaze look like when we're engaging critically with a film, whether we're making or watching it? And so Borden was actively thinking about that when she was making her films.
I do see notes of caution in here, though, to not assume that, you know, it's kind of like the old thing where somebody used to say, well, that needs a woman's touch. Well, not all women are the same and therefore don't have the same touch.
Right. I mean, it's sort of ironic, I think, that Martha Coolidge talks about how on a very rare occasion she actually got a gig because they thought they needed a woman filmmaker for the project. And so very once in a while that actually worked for her. In fact, I think that's how she ended up getting the film Valley Girl. But I think, you know, in general, that's a dangerous thing because, it then limits the types of genres and, what is a film that needs a woman's touch, in quotes. You know, I mean, that's a concept I think we probably want to stay away from. I'm not sure.
Well, and this gives us a chance to consider that, you know, that there aren't certain genres that women tend to gravitate to. It sounds like women independent filmmakers do it all.
Absolutely. I just wrote about a filmmaker, Jennifer Reeder, who made a horror film, and that's been her genre. But she has a film, that Knives and Skin, that came out at the Berlin Film Festival and is screening at Tribeca later this spring. And, you know, this is a scary genre.
Does anybody ever do a blind test in film festivals or something, you know, tell me which films were made by women, anything like that?
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember reading how they solved the discrepancy or the discrimination in the symphony orchestras. And what they did is they had the audition simply be behind a curtain, so they couldn't tell whether it was a woman or a man who was auditioning. And it, like, instantly solved the problem of the imbalances of there being more men to women. And it's just not easy to do that with filmmaking and those kinds of professions, because there's a lot of ways for us to know about a project before we even see it as a jury member on a film festival. And so, you know, how can the Oscars ever really take gender out of the mix? It's a lot more complicated.
A lot more complications to talk about, too, with Michelle Meek. The book is called Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. You can join the conversation by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I thank you for listening. We are talking about independent female filmmakers, which is also the title of a book edited by Michelle Meek, subtitled A Chronicle Through Interviews, Profiles, and Manifestos, a chance to get to know some of the women who've been toiling, in some cases in obscurity. In some cases, they have gone on to Hollywood and had great success there as well. But women who have been working in independent films largely because they couldn't get, or at least in some cases because they couldn't get into the Hollywood system. You can join the conversation on the Exchange with Michelle Meek at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Another name I want to bring in here, Lisa Cholodenko, gets a chapter in the book, and she, again, seems to have made the big crossover from indie to more mainstream fare.
Right, absolutely. And she talks, it's very interesting in her interview, she talks about, as a writer, coming up with her projects and learning over the years how to actually shape her projects and integrate some more comedy. You know, the difference between a film like High Art, which she made early in her career, and then a film like The Kids Are All Right. It's almost amazing to think of it as the same director. I mean, there are some similarities, but you know, and collaboration and how that works in co-writing a project.
I'm intrigued by the fact that she has been recognized for showcasing LGBTQ people, but doesn't make a big deal out of it. She likes to just put them in there with no labels, which I suppose is how anybody thinks it should be at this point.
Right. I mean, I think several of the filmmakers actually talk about how they would sort of bristle when someone would ask them what it was like to be a woman filmmaker, because they didn't want to be put in some category that was limiting, and they felt like that was a category that was very limiting. And some of them wanted to make, you know, big films. They wanted to make all different kinds of genres. They didn't want to feel like, oh, if I'm labeled as LGBTQ or as a woman, then this is going to limit the types of projects that I can make. And you know, one project like that then kind of starts to define you, which some of them resisted.
You know, there was something, too, in Lisa Cholodenko said in an interview that she, I don't want to be in this ghetto anymore. And she was referring to independent films, about how, you know, people are sort of stuck there because they can't get into the Hollywood version of the film world. But so on one hand, she says, I don't want to be stuck in this ghetto. But she also sees great value in the ghetto.
Right. I mean, again, it comes down to that creative control. And, you know, there's a lot more of it to be had in independent filmmaking. But again, it's about impact. I mean, filmmakers want their movies to be seen and shared and influence and people and have, you know, have fans and have people think about their work and engage with it. And that's really important to them.
She was something that Lisa Cholodenko says, too. She talks about the increasing outlets for film work, which we've talked about a bit. I mean, is Netflix blowing up independent? I mean, are things that might have been independent projects becoming projects that are going straight to Netflix, straight to Prime, straight to Hulu, whatever?
Well, there was a period of time when people were saying that independent film was dead because there weren't the same kinds of bidding wars that there had been at film festivals for some films, and the numbers weren't as high. And then, you know, inevitably things change, and Amazon and Netflix and some of these companies came to be, and all of a sudden there's much more demand for content. I mean, there's an enormous demand for content, and everyone is, you know, really wants to be able to discover the next big talent that's going to have a great show or film. And so in a way, that's opened up a lot of opportunities. It still tends to be male dominated at the top and down the line. But I still am optimistic that the demands of the audience hopefully will help guide this. And also the fact that, you know, many of us are talking and focusing on how female directors are important and, you know, making sure that there is balance, and the conversation has changed, and focusing on that is going to make some changes happen, I think.
I learned so much from your interview with Martha Coolidge. I know we've talked about her a bit already, but there's a point in that interview when you traded thoughts on the things that audiences cheer for. And it might have been you who brought up Kevin Spacey's character,
right,
breaking a plate in An American Beauty. And the audience goes, yeah, it's like, you know, he's won the struggle with his wife. But the difference in how people view that scene seems to be central to why we need women making films.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important not only for women to be making films, but for us to be engaging critically with the work that we're seeing always. Because if a scene like that, you know, when you watch it the first time, you're on his side. You want him to get out of this rut that he's in. And yet when you really step back, and I show that scene in classes and that I teach that film sometimes, it's a scene of domestic violence. I mean, he picks up a plate and he throws it against the wall, and that's how he is able to sort of assure his position in the family with his wife and daughter. And everyone, they both, you know, sort of shut up and take notice of him at that point. And that's extremely problematic. And I think, I don't know what the writer or director had in mind for that particular scene, but I think it's important for us to engage critically with it so that we're seeing the many layers that are at work there.
So I wonder how often you have your students at Bridgewater State think about the characters who are not the main characters in a story. Because when I think about particularly American Beauty and the like, it's Allison Janney, was that who played his wife?
It was
a while ago for all of us, but the point is, you get to a point where you realize, oh wait, you know, all the attention was focused on the main, that character was well fleshed out, well played, well written. The surrounding characters sometimes can be just sort of there to contribute lines.
Right. I mean, I think it's interesting that, Martha Coolidge's film Real Genius is one of the only films of that era in that genre that had a female genius just displayed kind of unproblematically in the film, whereas all of the other films about geniuses, you know, and there were kind of a lot in that era, were all male.
Mm-hmm.
So minor characters can mean a lot. She was not the protagonist of the film, but she was an important character in that kind of groundbreaking way.
So it seems like we're taking a long time to get to a point where women are so used to being in certain roles and certain positions that we no longer comment on them. It's like we're still talking about the one woman who won an Oscar for Best Director. You know, I guess by the time we get a second one, we'll maybe stop having to talk about the first woman this, the first black that, you know, but we're still in that point, aren't we?
We are. And I think women who transcend different kinds of genres are get, you know, noted. I was just at a conference this week, and you know, Patricia Smith, who spoke there, was talking about how Zhao was commented on for the writer being a Western, and who, you know, that this was very unlikely genre for her. Why? Why should it be unlikely for her? I mean, you know, a male filmmaker who's making that film is probably also not a cowboy. So what difference does it make, you know?
Excellent point. I was surprised. At some point in the book, you let us know that the industry got a little better for women in the 90s, and then it looks like got worse. The numbers sort of went back to where they'd been, or slid anyway. What happened?
I think there was a backlash to some extent, but I also think that it's really troublesome when people think we've done it. Feminism is obsolete. You know, there's no need for it anymore. It's pointless. And I think one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is that it's become very strikingly obvious that feminism is not obsolete, that we really do need to work towards gender equality in many ways. And so that has put us more on a alert kind of point of view, which is essential for progress. And I think for over a decade, I think that point of view had kind of been buried.
When we were talking earlier about the age of the project, you started Independent Female Filmmakers before the Me Too moment, and you got your own hashtag, More Women Filmmakers. Did the trajectory of the book change at all from Me Too?
Absolutely, in the sense that all of the women filmmakers were pretty much asked about how they felt about the industry changing now in light of what was happening. And they were all very aware that there has been a shift, if not in the numbers yet, at least in sort of the public awareness and consciousness about women filmmakers, as well as representations of women on the screen.
So give us a view from the indie side of the industry. When a woman, or I guess for anybody for that matter, leaves indie film or at least begins to make mainstream films in the studio system, is there some grumbling or talk of sellouts among indie film people?
It happens so rarely that.
Oh, really?
I don't think so. Personally, I would not have that opinion, and I don't really know if other people do think that. I guess there's always some people that are going to criticize your work. The more visibility you get, the more open to public criticism you are. It's just the simple fact. But, I think, again, it's about impact. So they can question it all they want, but if you want to have a bigger impact, you need a bigger audience.
I noticed that Barbara Koppel's in the book. We had a chance to talk to her a couple of years ago. She's the same age as Martha Coolidge. She visited with us a few years ago during the Ashland Independent Film Festival. What kind of dues did she pay? I mean, it sounds like people really had to spend a lot of years toiling in relative obscurity to get their bigger projects made.
I think to some extent that's true of most filmmakers, even the ones that make it. But, you know, Barbara Koppel was actually one of the two filmmakers, her and Deepa Mehta, who really didn't think that discrimination played a large role in her career path, in fact. Barbara Koppel got an enormous amount of kind of coaching and mentorship from the Maisel brothers. And she, you know, she was kind of confident with the technology at an early point in her career, and you know, is obviously a very take charge type of person who's willing to take risks and get in there for the story, and she did very early on, and her first film got her quite a lot of notoriety. So I think she had kind of an exceptional career as a female filmmaker, but she also acknowledges that her career was much different because she was a documentary filmmaker, which was seen as a less commercial region and something that was more open to women filmmakers in general.
Really? I wonder why.
Why? Which part?
why people would think, oh, well, it's a documentary, so of course it's a woman directing it, or you know, she's a woman, so she'll be directing documentaries, whatever the approach is. But the idea that women get more often connected to documentaries than narrative films.
I think it's not necessarily that they get more connected to it. I think that when there's less money in the picture, it's more open, perhaps, in terms of, you know, that the Hollywood filmmaking is a completely, you know, money-driven industry, of course, and documentary filmmaking is not. People are making films because they feel very passionate about the topic, and they sometimes spend many years making a film, and to have it see the light of day. You know, I just worked as an associate producer on a film, Salvage, that screened at South by Southwest, and the director worked on the film for many years before it finally was, she worked on editing and getting it out there.
Wow, that was a long project.
Absolutely, and they often are.
So for some of the younger women here, Miranda July, born 1974, is the youngest person in the book. Has it been a very different world? I mean, is her experience in independent filmmaking very different from some of the older women? Has it been any easier, question.
It hasn't really been easier, unfortunately. I really wish that I could say, because she was coming of age at a later time, that she had a lot easier of a time. But that's not really been the case. At least that's not how she reports it in the book. And I think, you know, for Miranda July, I mean, she's such an interesting filmmaker. I mean, me and you and everyone we know is just one of the most interesting and great films that I've ever seen. And but I think it's still seen as so different in terms of the genre that it is. I mean, I don't find it that way, but I guess I'm used to watching a lot of different kinds of work, and so I'm more open to it perhaps, but I find it really an exciting kind of work, and I don't know that the commercial potential of her work has been seen in the way that it deserves perhaps.
And finally, Michelle, before we have to go, the hashtag More Women Filmmakers, what kind of responses have you gotten to that?
So I started it on Twitter. I mean, I'm not on Twitter. I'm sorry. I started on Instagram. And I've gotten mostly very positive responses, but there have been a few men who have questioned what I'm doing. Especially, I've called out some quotes from the book of the female filmmakers themselves. And once in a while, I get someone who really, that wants to believe there's no discrimination, which is hard for me to put any value on. But
yeah, the numbers are still very different. It's about 3-1 men to women and across the industry, isn't it still?
Yeah, the numbers are not good, unfortunately.
Michelle Meek is the editor of the book Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. Michelle, thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.